My name is Bernard Haeckel, and I am a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, where I teach courses on history and politics and Islamic law, and I focus mainly on Arabia in my work.
Hi, Bernard. I'm Madawi Al-Rashid, and I'm professor of social anthropology at King's College London. My area of specialization is the Middle East, with special reference to Saudi Arabia. And I look at history, politics, society, and religion. And I teach courses on the anthropology of the Arab world, and also with specific reference to Saudi Arabia.
Okay, excellent. It's really nice to have this conversation. And we should begin perhaps by talking about the big event of the week, which was the killing of Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, or rather in Pakistan. And since he was a Saudi or a former Saudi, having been stripped of his nationality, it's perhaps appropriate that we should begin with him.
I agree.
Okay, I let me give you very quickly a sort of a thumbnail sketch of how I see him. I see bin Laden as having been produced, literally manufactured, as the great hero of the jihad against the Soviets in the 1980s, and that this image, this creation, this public relations exercise, which was really an exercise of the Saudi government and intelligence services, but also perhaps the Americans and the Pakistanis. I think that image went to bin Laden's head, and he thought that his success, or alleged success, in Afghanistan, even though he saw very little actual combat, could be translated into real political power back home when he returned in 1990 to Saudi Arabia. And when he did return and he started to get involved in politics, namely by giving the Saudi royals advice on what they should do with the socialists in Yemen, what they should do about the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, he was told very firmly that he should mind his own business and not get involved in politics. And this, I think, was the beginning of a disenchantment, an experience of disenchantment with the Saudi political system, which ultimately led, after many other years, to a much greater radicalization and finally a break with the system.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Bernard, because you worked on Yemen and I worked on the other side, on Saudi Arabia, for a long time. And I think, you know, the connections are there. Let's just remember that Osama bin Laden's father was an immigrant in Saudi Arabia in the 1930s, and he made his fortune as a result of construction work that he did for the Saudi government in terms of the buildings, the infrastructure, the planning of the cities, the even Mecca, the expansion of the mosque. So in a way, he was the typical immigrant from Hadramaut, from Yemen, who comes to Saudi Arabia and make it. And then he has all these children, and Osama bin Laden is one of them. The interesting thing is Osama bin Laden was fully integrated economically in the system, but obviously he had no tribal roots in Saudi Arabia. He came from Hadramaut, but he made it. He made it economically. And as a result of this special sort of relationship he had with powerful princes, he was able to sort of see himself playing a role other than the subcontractor for the government. And okay, that happened at a time when Saudi Arabia was bubbling with various Islamist trends, with people that the Saudi government hosted, such as, for example, exiles from Egypt and from Syria, from Iraq, all these kind of Islamists, mainly people who were Muslim Brotherhood, and also there are lots of variations within this Islamic sphere, that bin Laden was part of any Saudi youth at the time who was exposed to this diversity within the Islamist field, or what we call now the Islamist. And therefore, in 1979, when Afghanistan was invaded, And as you said, I agree fully with you that the whole project of creating mujahideen, that is, you know, holy warriors, if you like, to go to Afghanistan and mobilize Muslims around the globe. I mean, from the United States to the streets of London to Pakistan to North Africa, all those kind of places were supposed to bring in or send these jihadis to go and fight. And they did go and fight, and we had preachers, for example, here in London, recruiting and also organizing relief efforts to rescue the refugees who were escaping from Afghanistan as a result of the Soviet occupation. And as you said, you know, the Americans, the British, the Saudis, and the Pakistani intelligence services all cooperated. It was part of defeating the Soviet Union in the Cold War. But obviously, these policies do not usually end up the way those who designed them wanted, and the policy backfired. So we get this figure called Osama bin Laden, who was charismatic, who had the ability to bring in what was called the Arab Afghan. The interesting thing is in Saudi Arabia, we always hear that bin Laden is the outsider and he has no tribal roots. Therefore, nobody follows him. Nobody likes him. He has no legitimacy in that country. But in fact, the fact that bin Laden was an outsider was to his advantage. He was able to break the rigid tribal groupings and hierarchy and was able to appeal to a sort of a global Muslim community. So everybody saw that there is something that bin Laden could offer. He himself didn't have tribal roots in Saudi Arabia, and this, I think, was his strength. He was able to bring in or appeal to Egyptians, Libyans, Pakistanis, and he was very sort of cosmopolitan in a way. He went there and he started dressing up like these Pashtun people in Afghanistan. And in a way, his return, as you said, was problematic. The Saudis couldn't have given this job to go to Afghanistan to a Saudi from, let's say, some of the tribal groups, because obviously they didn't want the honor of performing jihad abroad to come back home and haunt them. So they thought bin Laden was just an immigrant. And this attitude led to sort of the consequences that the whole world had to sort of suffer from.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that he was not a tribal, and even within Yemeni society, he was, you know, someone who belonged to a very low status group. From, I think they were Banats, they were construction people. You know, meant that he had no status politically in the system. I'm having actually some feedback here. Are you having the same thing?
Feedback?
Like I can hear myself in my ears.
No, I'm fine. No? I could hear you.
Okay. Anyway, I'll just go back to what I was saying about him. What's interesting, as you said, is that he could appeal to large numbers of people. And as I think you've also shown in your own work, the Al-Qaeda group in Saudi Arabia had membership from every social group, regional group in the kingdom. So it was quite representative as a movement of a cross-section of all the population of the country.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. And the interesting thing, all this happened and accelerated in the 1990s at the beginning of Saudi Arabia getting really into globalization, getting into sort of, you know, transnational links in very big way. And therefore, this appeal to Muslims who are not ethnic, who are not part of a national entity. So everybody was just a Muslim. And it's the same kind of epoch, if you like, that that followed the Iranian Revolution, where the world Muslim, especially among immigrants in Britain, you know, they were beginning to be identified as Muslim rather than as Pakistanis or Bangladeshis or Arab. So this Muslim identity that Bin Laden was able to use and also help him to recruit. So he did succeed in that project, but in the 90s things changed dramatically because it is the event really that made Bin Laden change his mind vis-a-vis his sponsors, who were the Saudis. And that's when they fell out. And therefore, the Saudis by mid-1990 withdrew his passport and suddenly decided that he's not a Saudi. And therefore, he had to find refuge in places like Sudan, then move back to Afghanistan when the Taliban took over. So that in a way, was the history. But what we're facing today is this sort of war on terror, whereby the United States recruited other nations, other regimes, in order to support it against this sort of hunt for Bin Laden. And I think the last decade was very, very problematic. Bin Laden obviously was chased out of Afghanistan. He disappeared, with the exception of his tapes that he occasionally posted on the internet and other Arabic channels received. So he was trying to keep that sort of contact with his audience. But at the same time, I think things moved forward over the last 10 years. The Arab society realized that Bin Laden now is on the periphery. He sort of left the Arab homeland. Obviously, he would have liked to have roots in Arabia, because that's his project. The project is to bring Islam to the Arabs again. But it's interesting, because the Arabs today sit on the sacred geography of Islam, Mecca and Medina, the two holy cities. But in terms of their power, in terms of their hegemony, they don't have it. I don't see how Islam is linked with the Arabs. I mean, we all know that there are more Muslims in Britain, for example, than there are in Qatar. There are more Muslims in France, apparently 6 million people, that is more than Muslims in Libya. So the center of the demographic, perhaps cultural center of Islam, is no longer in Arabia. And this is interesting, because Bin Laden himself chose to go to the periphery of the Muslim world, as far as the Arabs are concerned. So there was this dimension, but I think the interesting thing about the what happened during these last 10 years after 9/11 is that we are beginning to see in Arab societies a new trend. This new trend is rejecting that kind of jihad associated with violence, associated with bombing innocent people. And I think that culminated in what happened in Tunisia and Egypt. I don't know what your thoughts on that, but I think this peaceful resistance to the regimes that were supported by the West. I mean, let's not forget that the United States supported Bin Laden, supported Ali Abdullah Saleh, and if they didn't support the Saudis financially, they did actually sell them quite a lot of expertise, military intelligence, military weapons, shared intelligence with them. They saw them as partners in this war. So in a way, these regimes felt very strong, and in a way they sent a message to America saying that we are so important to you in order to fight this Bin Laden, which assumed a mythical sort of iconic status. And what we have seen over the last 3-4 months is that the new trend in the Arab world is towards this peaceful resistance. People came to the streets unarmed, facing a strengthened security forces as a result of the last 10 years. So
I agree. I think that Bin Laden and the whole jihadi phenomenon is an inheritor of the you know, the pan-Arab and even pan-Islamic movements of several decades ago. So when bin Laden was talking about dignity, karama, or about justice, he really was talking about collective dignity, the dignity of all Muslims. What I see happening in Tunisia and Egypt and elsewhere is that people are asking for dignity not only as a group of Arabs or Muslims, but also as individuals. There's a move towards individual rights, or claiming and desiring individual rights, not wanting to be brutalized as individuals by the state, by these authoritarian states. And I think there is a real disconnect between bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and this new mood, this new demand that we're seeing across the Arab world towards greater individualism and greater personal rights. That's one point I wanted to make. The other point I want to make, going back to Saudi Arabia, is that the Saudi royal family has always used Islam to legitimize its rule. But built into the tradition and interpretation of Islam that they've promoted is this constant threat of extremism emerging. It's almost like handling fire. It can easily sort of slip out of your hand, and then you can lose control of it. And we saw this with the Ikhwan in the 1920s. And I think, again, with bin Laden, you have a person who really tried to apply Islam as he was, as he understood it, and as he thought Wahhabism interpreted Islam, and he was used by the state to promote this particular interpretation and version, which, as you know, is often very anti other kinds of Muslims rather than just anti-Christian or Jewish. It tends to focus at the bad Muslims, whether they're Sufis or Shi'is. And this is something that the Saudi royals have had a problem containing and controlling. And they ultimately, through the 1990s, were able to control it. And then Al-Qaeda emerged very strongly in Arabia in the 2000s. And they again crushed it. But I always get the feeling that they're playing with fire. Using it when it's useful, pulling it back when it's not. Most recently, they've allowed their religious scholars to argue not only that demonstrations are illegal and prohibited by Islam, but they've also encouraged an anti-Shiism that is reminiscent of what they did in the late 70s and early 80s when the Iranian Revolution threatened them.
Yes, absolutely. You know that the problem is the state itself. You know, all states, I think, are founded on some kind of conquest and some violence. But not many states are founded on a religious sort of ideology, whereby you incorporate territories in order to make them Muslim, to Islamize them. You know, you're right. I mean, we've written on this, that the Saudi sort of mindset, when they the way they sold the idea of a unified Arabia under the Al Saud was that we, and I speak here as a Saudi, we are all blasphemous, and our Islam is the wrong one, and we have actually degenerated into this sort of blasphemy and innovations, and therefore we needed to be brought back to Islam thanks to the Wahhabi tradition and thanks to the Al Saud. And this is very unique to Saudi Arabia. And it does not many post-colonial states in the Middle East share that. So therefore, this kind of logic involves a continuous expansion, because you're always going to find Muslims who are not going to be doing the right thing, and you have to go and tell them to stop it. And if they don't, then they are actually subjecting themselves to violence. And therefore, we have this situation in Saudi Arabia whereby the logic of forming a state in the 20th century had to stop at international boundaries that were drawn by Britain at the time. And therefore, right. Jihad had to be directed inward. That is, you can't go and spread the true Islam beyond these borders, and you have to direct it at the society itself. So let's start with our own society and make them Muslims and keep doing that until perhaps an opportunity arises, and then we could do the real jihad. And this is exactly what happened during the 80s when the opportunity came for those people to go to Afghanistan after they've been sort of dormant, just sort of Islamizing, if you like, their own society, telling them to do this and stop doing that, and preaching and making them good Muslims according to the definition of the Wahhabi tradition. But there is the danger, as you said. The interesting thing is that from the moment Saudi Arabia was created within the sphere of influence of Britain, the British thought that the Al-Saud are their safeguards against these conservative Wahhabis, and therefore they could not imagine an Arabia without this ruling family, because they are the safeguards. They can control them. They control the sort of the inner demons of this society. And the same logic was applied by the United States after 9/11, is that this society produces these fanatics who are going to go on jihadi sort of expeditions, but only the ruling family could keep them under control. Hence the alliance that has been going on for decades between the United States and Saudi Arabia. But nobody is realizing that this kind of situation is counterproductive, and there is a cycle of violence that keeps manifesting itself, that it keeps coming since 1927, the first clash between the Wahhabis and the outside world, at the time was Britain, that was in control of Kuwait, took place. But then everybody thought that everything was fine, oil came, and everybody was engaged in this consumption that they enjoyed, and therefore the problem will not come again. And it did come again in 1979 when another character called Juhayman al-Utaybi imposed the siege on the mosque during the Hajj, the pilgrimage, and the Saudis had to call the French to help them to squash the rebellion and free the hostages. Then it happened again. In a way, the 1980s was a way out of this problem that was building up in Saudi Arabia. It gave a sort of an outlet for this jihadi effervescence that was building inside Saudi Arabia as a result of state sponsorship. Let's not forget the economy of all this. There is a state that is sponsoring all this kind of preaching, building mosques, encouraging this kind of religious education, and keeping a blind eye. And in the 1980s, they used it. It proved to be beneficial. But then it backfired in the 90s and culminated in 2001 and later on when Saudi Arabia itself became a target for bin Laden's al-Qaeda activities in Saudi Arabia. More than 200 people died in Saudi Arabia in various attacks. So in a way, yes, we are seeing a change today in the Arab world. Now, we have seen it in Egypt, and you're absolutely right. There are individual rights. There is this global discourse on civil liberties and human rights that is actually so refreshing to see in countries like Egypt and Tunisia. But the worry is that in a place like Saudi Arabia, I don't know if you're aware that there were plans to start to join in and call for political reform. And there were calls on the internet to have a day of rage when Saudis would go mm-hmm. and demonstrate. Now, Saudi Arabia mobilized the religious establishment again. So it is very useful to issue fatwas and say that, you know, demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations are not allowed in Islam. If you have anything to say to the rulers, if you want to advise them in secrecy, that's fine. But going on demonstration is creating chaos, it's bad for the country, and it's un-Islamic. And therefore, the religious establishment proved to be useful. Another role it played, as you said, they described any kind of peaceful demonstration as a conspiracy by Shia and Iranians against the Sunni pious leadership of Saudi Arabia. And therefore, this double use of religion, I think, is extremely dangerous, because when the government suppresses peaceful demonstration, peaceful resistance, it creates an opportunity for people to choose violence. And I think this is the biggest worry in a place like Saudi Arabia.
I mean, I agree with what you're saying, but when I look at Saudi Arabia, I look at its history, I see the following. I see a royal family that has a long history, a country that benefited from colonial largesse, but was never colonized. I also see a country that's internally quite divided in terms of either tribal or regional or sectarian identities. I also see a country that has experienced the most astonishing development with modernization because of oil wealth in a very short time frame, massive urbanization, and also this history of a particular interpretation of Islam. Now, we know that all states will use violence, have to have a monopoly on violence to keep control of and keep themselves in power. And I don't see sort of a way out from the present closure to greater rights, greater civil liberties, given how much oil the country has, where the price of oil is, and what capacity that gives to the state to basically buy off people and buy consent, essentially. I also see a royal family that has a lot of problems internally. It's also has problems because of its size. It's no longer a small family, and it lives in very complicated ways with the rest of society. And so when I look at all these factors, I wonder, you know, what's the way out? How can change come about without it being incredibly violent? Especially as there's tremendous turbulence around the country. I mean, Yemen, as you know, is on the verge of becoming a failed state with many, many problems, both, I mean, real in terms of running out of water, running out of oil, huge population, lots of divisions and cleavages within the society. You have certainly Iran as well. I mean, it's not a negligible force in this region, and it has its own agenda. So when you look at the region and you look at the constitution of Saudi Arabia internally, it's very difficult to imagine how change can come you know, given all these factors?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Saudis themselves have actually imagined ways of gaining more rights, increasing their political participation, having institutions that protect the individual, such as, for example, civil society organizations. I mean, if you remember, since 9/11, there are more than at least 8-9 petitions that were people got together to think about how they want to see their country. And just recently, in the last 3-4 months, there were 2 petitions. One was described as a national document, and it clearly asked for an elected parliament, separation of power, local autonomy, which is really interesting because it links up with your point about how diverse Saudi Arabia and divided. But in a way, being diverse and divided is not a problem in itself, because I don't know of any society in the world, as an anthropologist, that doesn't have internal divisions. If you look at the Arab world, all the Arab world is tribal. In the south of Egypt, in Sa'id, they're all tribal. In Yemen, they're tribal. In Qatar, in Kuwait, Kuwait is tribal. And there are people who are not tribal in Saudi Arabia. And therefore, the Saudis, in these last 2 petitions, wanted to have some kind of local autonomy. They wanted to rule themselves. I mean, you know, we live in a country where this dynasty controls everything, from sports club to embassies, to even charities. There isn't an autonomous space where society can actually exercise some kind of independence. The press is controlled by the state. The local councils are controlled by the state. But not only the state, they are controlled by princes. You know, I mean, 20, 30 years ago, there wasn't a single Saudi prince who was an ambassador apart from Bandar bin Sultan in Washington. Yeah. Do you realize
that? I mean, it's because the family has gotten so big.
Yes, but they are also taking jobs from the population. You know, right. Sports club are patronized by princes. Literary salons are patronized by princes. And this is new. 20, 30 years ago, there wasn't such heavy investment in these kind of spaces where people would exercise some kind of autonomy. So what has happened over the last 20, 30 years is there are multiple actors within the state. There are multiple princes who control the media, religion, everything. And this situation, Saudis are finding very difficult. The joke among some Saudis is that within a couple of years, all the primary school principals, headmasters, are going to be Saudi princes. And this is actually worrying for them. So these petitions wanted to have some kind of participation. They did not call for the overthrow of the regime as a whole. And even then, we find that people are becoming daring, in the sense that they are even announcing that they have established a political party, which is something unheard of in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, let alone Saudi Arabia. And also they are very critical. The interesting thing is that if you look at Talal ibn Abdul Aziz, who is part of this Free Princes movement in the 1960s, he was calling for a constitutional monarchy in the 60s. And he was in exile in Cairo and then in Beirut. But then he returned to Saudi Arabia. He's never had any political role, but he patronizes culture and education. And he managed to find his place, but not actually as a main political actor. Obviously, his son is more known in the world than he himself, and that is Al-Walid bin Talal, because of his global sort of business. And he, over the last 2 months, he came out on BBC Arabic television, and later in Egypt on one of the Egyptian channels, to warn against what is going to happen after King Abdullah dies. He is seriously worried about what his brothers are going to do. And he was supporting this idea that people should be involved in government if the Al Saud are going to stay in power. Otherwise, it's going to be a crisis. And he obviously didn't name his brothers, but it was so clear his references were to the Sudairi Sevens. This is a group who are the brothers of the half-brothers of the king, whose mother belongs to the Sudairi family. And the crown prince, Sultan, the minister of interior, Naif, the governor of Riyadh, Salman, and many others are part of this group that are actually de facto rulers of Saudi Arabia, even now when King Abdullah is in office. The problem is quite a lot of them are extremely old, and nobody knows what is going to happen when they die. One thing for sure is that each one of those seven had managed to put his son in as his deputy, including the king. I mean, the king handed over the leadership of the National Guard to his son before he went to New York. And therefore, we have a situation here whereby we have multiple royalties controlling everything in the country, and their sons are bound to inherit their position if they die. Now, there remains the position of the king. So what I think is going to happen is that the king is going to be a ceremonial figure from now on, perhaps an old person, whereby he rules and he is good for external consumption, for these pomp rituals of royalty. But the actual functioning of the state, the main ministries such as defense, interior, foreign office, these are already controlled by powerful princes that cannot be easily displaced and given to commoners. So this is the situation that Saudis are worried about, including Prince Talal. And they try to imagine a new situation where there is serious political reform and not simply handouts given by the king occasionally. And a lot of Saudis, I think, now do believe that the king is actually distributing what belongs to them. They have got into this sort of understanding that they have contributed to the creation of Saudi Arabia. It's not just the single man, this cult of personality where you have the Ibn Saud unifying the country. Remember, it wasn't an act of a single man. And let's not forget the First World War and the contribution of Britain in this creation. But Saudis themselves feel, and they have been writing about their own role and contribution in making Saudi Arabia, and therefore what the king gives them as a handout is actually theirs to begin with. So we are beginning to see these signs. But I agree with you that, you know, the royal family has paralyzed important tribal groups, important bureaucrats. Even today, bureaucrats are actually overruled by royalty. So, and not to mention the religious establishment and the religious figures who have become state functionaries. I mean, they're employees. They have limited autonomy.
Yeah, I agree. And now, I mean, to be fair to the Saudi royals, they don't argue that their interpretation of Islam is consistent or compatible with democracy. I mean, they don't hide the fact that they believe that they have a right to rule and that people have no right beyond just giving advice in the way that they are to be ruled. And you put your finger on something very important, which is that if change is going to happen, the change has to happen first and foremost within the royal family. It has to reform itself. And this gets me to the next point that I want to make, which is that most human beings, including certain institutions, don't really change unless they're absolutely forced to change. I mean, we often know that people don't start working out and exercising until they have some brush with a heart attack or death. And there's something about the present configuration of power not wanting to look ahead and say, you know, what are we going to look like 20 years from now? I think they're very much in a presentist approach, which is, you know, what is in my interest now and what do I have to do to maintain my power within the family? And in particular, when the price of oil is high as it is now, the rule of thumb is that, you know, change becomes even more difficult because you can buy your way out of most problems. As we saw with the $130 billion that they gave over the next 5 years to calm down their population. And so, you know, I would love to see the family reform and the country reform. I just don't see how that can happen given that I don't think enough pressure is going to be exerted from below. And this is partly to do with what's happening in the region. I think that Saudis look at the implosion of Libya and the violence in Syria and in Yemen, and they say, you know, maybe it's okay to stay, to keep things as they are, because change might be much worse. And you know, this is also a society that puts a tremendous premium on a social order and a certain degree of stability. I mean, in one conversation I had recently with a Saudi royal, who is one of the Sudairis that you mentioned, he said something very revealing, I thought. He said, you know, we know our people. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, our people are very worried about the honor of their women. They don't want to see chaos in society because it might involve the violation of their women folk and their honor. And we know this about them, and we've told them that, you know, if they become restive, that might become a real issue for them and for the society. So he felt confident that on March 11th, the so-called Day of Rage, that nothing was going to happen, in part because of this claimed knowledge about the Saudi people. Now, you know, I don't know how true you know, this assessment is, but it has the ring truth about it. I don't know what you think.
Well, I think I'm interested in the way that you brought women into the picture. And I'm actually working on this issue on the state and gender relations. I think the security of Saudi women is not actually guaranteed even today. I mean, we know that Saudi women now are abused, are physically abused. They're not secure. They're not secure. And the proof of what I'm saying is the statistics that are published by the state agencies, by human rights organizations that are quasi sort of independent organizations. By the rape cases, I don't know if you remember the Fatat al-Qatif in 2007. And this is the story of a girl who was blackmailed by a man. And then he asked her, because he had a photo of her, and he asked her to go to a shopping center where he was going to give it back. And then he kidnapped her together with seven other men, and they gang raped her. And then you have the religious scholars sentencing this girl to hundreds of lashes. So a lot of people now talk about the security of their women. Under the present regime, it's not achieved. I mean, women are scared to go out. There had been cases whereby people, women are raped, filmed, and post the video clip is posted on the internet. And therefore, this argument that the Saudis, I don't think any society in this world would like to see its women raped. And I think why Saudis hesitate in putting more pressure on their leadership. There are several reasons. One of them is Saudi Arabia doesn't have organizations to bring people together, independent organizations. So we don't have trade unions. We don't have political parties. We don't have interest groups that come together. You know, it's not allowed for three people to meet without permission. Even the informal literary gathering that people have in their own houses are heavily monitored. And therefore, there is no experience or knowledge of how to organize yourself. The internet opened new avenues for young Saudis. And remember, you know, 60% of Saudis are very young, under the age of 25. So that's one reason. The other reason is these economic benefits that you mentioned. They are appealing, and there are huge sections of society that are benefiting from this, from big tribal chiefs to the usual, employee of the government. Still, most Saudis are employed in state as civil servants. You know, the private sector employs only 13% Saudis. The rest of the private sector is foreign. This is unusual, unheard of in any other country. And therefore, there is the economic side, but also there is the problem of what happened in neighboring countries, such as you mentioned Libya, you mentioned Syria now, Yemen, but previously Iraq. Iraq was a catalyst in sort of making a lot of people in Saudi Arabia rethink their priorities. Nobody wants to see a civil war, especially in a society where you have a religious establishment making every other Muslim that doesn't believe in its own tradition as a non-Muslim, declaring them kafir, blasphemous. So, for example, the Shia in the Eastern Province, are, if they go and demonstrate, they are immediately described as a fifth column for Iran. But the Shia had been demonstrating in that part of Saudi Arabia since the 1950s. Before Iran became revolutionaries. The same thing in Hijaz, that is the western part of Saudi Arabia where all the pilgrim centers are. The people there have a high level of education. They have a high level of expertise. They were the first educated population in Saudi Arabia. But they are also divided because there is a tribal element and there is the sedentary population of the major cities of Mecca, Medina, and Jeddah. And in those elite merchant families are scared of what they call the people who didn't or hadn't historically lived in the cities, the tribal population. And the Saudi regime plays on these differences. At one point, they promoted the merchant classes because they needed them as bureaucrats, as people to run the state. But at another time, they dropped them and promoted another merchant class from Central Arabia, from Najd. And the tribal population is sort of in between. And therefore, they've created the conditions where every community is scared of the other community. And this deters people from communal activity. But I think there is hope. As we're approaching the end of our conversation, I think we see signs of people coming together, perhaps in two regions, whereby they ask for these rights that we talked about earlier. Human rights, basically. They don't want to be arrested for years and years without trial. And do you know that women, as we're talking about women, have been demonstrating in front of the Ministry of Interior in order to ask for their sons, fathers, husbands, who have been imprisoned for years.
Yes.
And in Jeddah in February, when they had flooding and 10 people died, it was a woman who went to the street to talk to the governor of the province and tell him that they've had enough of corruption in the local authority, which meant that development plans, urban planning, has gone completely wrong and made people vulnerable to flooding. Poverty you know, we talk about economic largesse, but do you realize that there is a substantial population in Saudi cities and in, for example, Najran and Asir, and in the northern borders, Tabuk, Ar'ar? Those are people who live under the poverty line, according to United Nations statistics. And we are talking here about one of the richest states in the region, if not one of the richest in the world. So poverty, unemployment, all these kind of social, economic problems are not easy to contain if the royal family remains sort of deaf to these calls for political reform and an equal distribution of wealth. As any society in the Arab world in the last 20, 30 years, there is a huge gap between the very, very wealthy who are connected to the regime, who have benefited from these new liberal economies, investment, the stock market, and others who, because of their lack of education, linguistic skills, and connections, remain peripheral. And Saudi Arabia has the same problem, perhaps not as much as Egypt, but it exists there. And it's all about rising expectations. You know, poverty is not an absolute figure, but it is about rising expectation. What happens if you have a huge population of educated people who can't find jobs? Had it not been for their families, they wouldn't be able to survive. People are not getting married because they can't afford to marry. And there are other reasons why they're not marrying. People are divorcing. You know, so basically, you know, the divisions are there. There are class divisions emerging. They're tribal, they're sectarian, yes. But every society has these problems, and not every society is predestined to explode or remain the same. When there is pressure on a regime, it has to respond. Otherwise, it will actually sow the seeds of its own demise. And I can't see how the royal family would get this message and stop talking about these sort of cosmetic reforms, about men and women mixing in the Chamber of Commerce or in the economic forums in Jeddah. This is not real reform. This is just cosmetic reform for external consumption. And it divides Saudi society more than it unites it. And perhaps this is what the regime wants. It wants society to be divided, divided on gender issues. There are those who want women to drive, the others don't want her to drive. Those who want women to mix with men in schools and universities, and those who don't. As long as they keep talking about these issues, they're not going to get their real political reform that many people now desire.
That's right. I don't think we should overdetermine, though, the power of the state and of the royals. I mean, there are also real constraints. Management of the country that they have to account for and live within these particular constraints. And frankly, I mean, whilst I agree with most of what you say, if not all of it, I'm not sure I can see either in the present constellation of senior princes this awareness for the need for profound change. In fact, I see the very opposite taking place. Retrenchment, back to old habits because of what's going on in the region. Change is destabilizing. It's not wanted. And amongst the younger generation of princes, the sons or the grandsons, rather, of the founding king, it's difficult to get a sense of you know, who the ones who would be willing to change the system versus those who don't. And you had mentioned Al-Walid bin Talal and his father, but, you know, as you well know, within the system, they're not in the higher councils of decision-making.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I agree with you. But, I mean, you know, they are completely excluded from political power, but economically, Al-Waleed could actually make or break the Saudi stock market, it seems. I'm not an expert on economics and business, but apparently over the last 2-3 months when the stock, the shares plummeted in Saudi Arabia, he pumped quite a lot of money into the market to prevent a greater sort of problem. So I doubt whether he will be able to transform his economic power into real political power. And this is interesting because Saudi Arabia, it doesn't really conform to the Western model. Like if you're wealthy, you become powerful, especially in America. So I agree with you. But I don't think the younger generation are going to be able to, are willing to give part of their power. They would probably not conceive of giving away power. The only way things will change if there is societal pressure. And also if a prince is convinced that it is within the interest of the whole group to introduce some serious reform, political reform, in order to survive as a group. Otherwise, I don't see that there is the need or the pressure, the urgency of change. Plus the international community, for example, the United States, Britain, France, even China, Russia, they all have vested interest in Saudi oil, and they're not going to let the country go through any kind of turmoil. But sometimes, you know, things can get out of hand suddenly. So I think if there is a political agenda for reform from the king or from senior members of the royal family, then it should become a platform for discussion with interested parties. And maybe they would save the country, the international community, world markets, and themselves some kind of future disasters.
Yeah, I agree. Because, you know, if the Saudis had experienced anything like what happened in Libya, where most of the oil was cut off, the world would go into global depression, and I am sure there would be a discussion about invasion and taking control of the oil fields in order to maintain a steady and reliable flow of oil out of the kingdom.
I'm sure. I don't think Saudis would allow or would want to see their country invaded. I'm one of them that would be even, you know, it's the worst. And remember, you know, Saudi Arabia is not important for Saudis only. Remember that Saudi Arabia has got the two holy mosques, and there are at least 3-4 million Muslims coming during one season, the pilgrimage, not to mention throughout the year. So Saudi Arabia is not important only for Saudis. It's important for the international community. It's important for Muslims.
That's right. And I also think one last point about the family, the royal family. I mean, unlike other ruling families or ruling cliques in the Middle East, let's say the Assads of Syria or you know, the Husseins, the Saddam Hussein, his family in Iraq. This is a very large family. And it's also a family in which many different political orientations, even economic orientations and religious orientations are represented. So it would be possible to agree on somebody within the family who is more acceptable to the people than, let's say, within these other families and other countries, because within the Saudi royal family, you have some who are very rich and corrupt and others who are not corrupt and not so rich. You have those who are religious and those who are not. You have those who have good reputations, those who have bad reputations. So there's a certain resilience and power in the fact that this is a family that is entrenched in the history of the country, but also that is big and broad enough to have so many different potential candidates
Yeah, but you know, the ones who are peripheral, like all royalty, like all royal families, I mean, you know, we don't need to compare them to Saddam or Gaddafi or Assad. Compare them to Kuwait, to Qatar, to all these families, their closed system, and the powerful ones who have a military base are actually the ones who control the show. And the Saudis have a couple of people who do. You've got the king who controls the National Guard. You've got the Prince Sultan, the Minister of Defense, who controls the army, the navy, and the air force. And you've got Naif, who controls the Ministry of Interior, internal security, intelligence services. And, you know, sometimes we talk about a large royal family, but it is actually a very limited number of princes. You know, you don't want to discuss the third, fourth generation. Those are nothing compared to the power base of these three, four figures. Now, what happens amongst them is actually not known, and they have to divide the cake amongst themselves in order to satisfy their interest, plus give the distant branches a fraction of what they have. Yes, I mean, this is royalty. And once you don't have transparency, you don't have accountability, then it's a well-guarded secret. How long the system could remain like this, I think it depends on the Saudi people and the international community understanding that it's in its own interest to push Saudi Arabia for greater transparency, for some kind of political reform. In a way, it's in the interest of the royal family to share the burden of ruling the country with the people. So they're not the only one responsible for things when they go wrong. I think this message has to come across. But, you know, power makes you arrogant, and you don't want to give a fraction of it.
I mean, one Saudi wit, a very intelligent man, once told me, when I asked him to predict what Saudi Arabia will look like 10 years from now, said to me, "Tell me what the price of oil will be, and I'll tell you whether real change will happen or not." And I think there is some truth to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think on this note, we should finish our very interesting talk.
Yes.
And say that, you know, unfortunately, we academics work with data, with what we can analyze now. And I don't see myself as a fortune teller, a native fortune teller, to tell the world what will happen to Saudi Arabia in tomorrow or after tomorrow or when King Abdullah dies. I think the world will just have to wait and see and deal with whatever eventuality that may arise given the interconnected interest in a global world with a global economy. And Bernard, I think we should finish now. It was very enjoyable. And
thank you.
We'll keep in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Malawi.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.